Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another show of Dispatches, recorded here in Shambhala, Kalapa. And today I have the pleasure of having with me Mr. Chris Tamjidi, who is Shambhala Europe Director since the year 2002. Welcome.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, welcome. And Chris is actually here because he came to the Blossoming of the Sun festivities. And we thought in the Chronicles Dispatches group that it would be a wonderful thing to invite Chris to join us, not only because he's done a very good job throughout the years managing Europe and having Europe pretty much blossom in its own sunshine, but also because Chris really brings together a very unusual perspective for many of us North American students, in that he brings the European view, and he actually never did meet Trungpa Rinpoche, even though we are asking him to talk a little bit about it. So without any further ado, as you know, Chris, the way we organize the show is we ask you and all people we interview two questions. The first one being is, can you say a few things about the nature of your relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche? And the other one is, how does your life today express the commitment to serving his vision? So what was the nature of your relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche, or what is it, or what was it? What brought you in?
So I had done some retreats in Asia by myself, and I hadn't found them particularly helpful. And so I knew I wanted to do another retreat, which was at least 4 weeks long, which had meditation instruction, and which had at least 8 hours of practice a day. I think that was it. And so I called around the world to try to find that, and then somebody picked up the phone at what was then RMDC, and said, you know, yeah, we have a datum, come on down, you know. So I went over there, not knowing anything about Shambhala or about Trungpa Rinpoche, but I was very fortunate that Sarah Coleman was the kind of leader of the datum in my MI at the time. And I think for a whole month, I just didn't get it. I mean, her basic meditation instruction to me was, whenever I came into the room, was, whatever you're doing, stop it. Because, you know, I was very, you know, trying to figure it out and trying to, you know, manipulate or kind of have good meditation. And I didn't really understand that, but I was very attracted to that. It kind of drove me a little bit bonkers or irritated me. But it was also very somehow attracting. And then I went back to Europe, and I had, again, no connection to the Shambhala Sangha. I didn't really have time. And then I did another datan about a year and a half later. And again, I was very moved at some level, but also I found the whole thing a bit strange. You know, I thought Shambhala was an interesting place, but I wouldn't want to hang around too much there. And actually, and then it's interesting that you asked me this question. So, and then what actually kind of cemented it for me is I was going to take a year off work anyways, and I had kind of contacted a number of people. I'd done this datun, and I was kind of figuring out what to do, to go on a Sufi path or to become Buddhist or to study with some other people. And I had contacted some years previously a Western kind of New Age guru who was a very big figure in Germany. And he wrote some very interesting stuff. And when I came back from the datun, he kind of suddenly contacted me, which was a big deal because he didn't speak to anybody anymore, and said he'd like to talk to me. And so I went to see him, and he basically kind of was hinting at it. He would offer me a path. And I kind of said, well, that's interesting. I just come back from a datan, and I've kind of, you know... And he talked a lot about Trungpa Rinpoche in his tapes, so another thing. So I kind of said, well, you know, I'm not so interested anymore, but, you know, I'm curious to ask. And I kind of think I'm going to become, you know, going to go on this path. And he heaped all kinds of criticism on this. And, you know, he was one of these people from the alchemical tradition. And, you know, he talked about he knew a lot about the Sangha. He talked about the corruption in the Sangha, and about that the Tibetan Buddhist path was no longer a proper path anymore in our time, that it was the death of the Karmapa, and the da 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 da. And so I came out utterly confused out of this meeting, because, you know, I found it very auspicious that this person, you know, actually wanted to meet with me, which was very rare, that he knew so much about Shambhala and Karmapa and so on, but it was totally critical. And then, so I spent a week in total confusion, not knowing what to do. kind of, and his path was very much about, you know, kind of, you know, the secret society, alchemical path, inner transformation, all these things, you know. And then I had a dream where kind of it felt like a whole lineage of people were holding their hands, and the last one was Trungpa Rinpoche, and he just touched my heart. And this was during the day, and I woke up and I realized I can't follow a path where I can't trust my experience. And what this man was basically saying was, if you follow my path, you have to trust me. You can't trust your experience. Because I said, you know, I found this good about the Tao and good, and he was just critical. I think that was actually, for me, that moment of... And I had a number of other dreams after that. But that was kind of the first real sense of... Ah. And he was also very negative about Shambhala training. He found Shambhala training a pure corruption. And I was going to do a Shambhala training weekend for my first one that weekend, you know, after I saw this man. And so it was kind of interesting and auspicious. And then I realized, yeah, I want to go to the weekend. And I went to the weekend, and kind of that was it from then onwards.
Seems like both Sarah and this person gave you the same instruction, which is whatever you're doing, stop it. Don't do it.
Yeah.
And that's how to get you to do it.
Yeah, in some ways, yeah.
And how did you actually go further? Did you soon meet the Sakyong, or did you mostly work with older students?
Yeah, I reasonably slim think that was in 97. And then I met the Sakyong in November 97. And somebody had told me I should do Nondro straight away. So somebody kind of, which was because I was very ambitious. And so I went to see the Sakyong to go ask him for permission to do my Nondro straight away. Which of course everyone found very strange. But anyway, so I went to see him, and then in the interview, I took Bodhisattva vow with him at that point, and he gave, you know, I found a very interesting connection there, and I kind of my desire to do Nondro dissolved at that point, particularly because I was kind of touched by the idea of doing Bodhisattva vow. But so anyway, so then I saw the Sakyong, but that was it basically. I didn't see the Sakyong again until 2 years later. And then I spend most of my time, you know, with senior students, Sarah Coleman, or other people like Fabrice Midal. And that's kind of, I was raised by them, so to speak.
And do you think that in your relationship with Fabrice and your relationship with Sarah and so on, you actually had a feeling for who Trungpa Rinpoche was? I mean, what was it that attracted you to this specific karmic confluence called the... Buddha Dharma Sangha of Trungpa Rinpoche?
I think what initially attracted me to it was kind of not being able to get it, you know, which I guess now I would say was, or in some sense, the datun I did got, you know, in some ways closer to pointing out instructions than anything, or than many other things, you know. So there's this flavor, this kind of echo of non-conceptual mind, which was kind of fascinating, and I couldn't get it. So that was one thing. And then when I got into it, into the Sangha situation more, and especially into the teachings of the Vidyadhara, kind of the flavor of luminosity of it, you know. So both on the one hand the non-conceptuality of it, and the other hand the luminosity of it, and the potential it had. I mean, there's a sense of that. The vision of an enlightened society that actually had meaning for my situation. You know, I was in management, and you know, on the one hand, I would like to go deeper into a Buddhist path and step out of management, but on the other hand, my karma had brought me to that situation, or my life had brought me to that situation. So I think those two things, and the madness of it. I think in my first 3 days of it, somebody told me the whole region story. I thought I was actually interesting, you know. I didn't get turned off by that at all. I thought, oh, interesting. That's very, you know, very mature, I thought, actually, that whole process that had happened around the Regent, or what I understood at that point.
You probably are some of those, yet again, unusual people who maybe came to the path after having had a family lineage that also bathed you or wrapped you or surrounded you with the kind of almost mystery and discovery and heart connection. You were telling me that your father was Iranian and was actually, you come from a tradition of Sufis.
Yeah.
Do you think that actually affected you in some way in terms of ripening you for encountering Trungpa Rinpoche's lineage?
I mean, I guess so. I mean, I didn't, interesting thing about my father's Sufi tradition, I knew nothing about that. Until, you know, he was a executive of a large company, a hotel company, and, you know, he had whatever, 800 employees working for him, and that was his life. But once I was on a business trip, actually myself, and then on the way back, we heard that my grandfather was ill, and that we could visit him for the first time because he was going to receive treatment in Dubai for the first time. He actually left Iran. He never left Iran before that. And so we went to see him, and it was very touching because there are things going on like, you know, so the family would, he was ill, he had very low blood pressure, so his legs had to be bound up very tightly, and so that the blood would stay in his upper body. And once they were all sitting there tying his legs up, and the phone rang, and it was his teacher, his guru on the other end, his ara, they call it, and he was saying, "You're binding his legs up too tightly." And the thing which was so interesting for me was not that he did this, but was that they all giggled and were guilty. You know, it was a sense of that they grew up in this environment, that this person was always around who would know what was going on. Or once they left him sitting at the table for too long, and he wasn't allowed to sit for too long, but he wanted to join us at the table. And then, of course, the phone rings again, and everyone's just looking guilty. And, of course, it was this person on the phone saying he shouldn't be at the table anymore, you know. So there was something there which I never knew of, and my father never manifested, but in some sense, yeah, there was a kind of a flavor of devotion and non-conceptual, some kind of tradition there.
So how has that tradition, both in terms of your family lineage and having encountered Trungpa Rinpoche's triple gem and lineage, how does that manifest in your life these days? You have a very, I would say, important role in terms of bringing about the Sakyong's vision. How do you see the continuity of that command, which in your case, I think, probably comes from generations back in some interesting way?
I never thought of it in connection to my own lineage, but I mean, I guess, you know, I felt a strong attraction to the, initially to the Vidyadhara. I felt, you know, I found the Sakyong nice and interesting, but I wasn't particularly magnetized by him. And I had some dreams, and I think what kind of drove me was, I once, earlier on, in one of the first, I think in the first Datun, or just after that, I wrote a poem, which was about the Vidyadhara, and the last lines were, Chogyam has planted the victory banner, and the only question that remains is whether we have the confidence to proclaim that victory too. So I had a very strong sense like that, and I looked around me at the kind of shambles of the organization, and I was just kind of very personally touched, and it was kind of unbearable. And I guess that was initially what motivated me, that sense of kind of tasting that vision and kind of seeing in what a, not a sad state, but it was certainly not a manifest state yet, you know. And I guess that drives me in some sense. Of course, there's my own personal ambition. It's, you know, it's always inseparable. I mean, of course, I'm an ambitious person, but ambition, you know, on the one hand is devotion, on the other hand, you know. And so I guess I certainly feel a strong connection and a strong longing, both to kind of make the Vidyadhara's world manifest, and now also to the Sakyong. I mean, my relationship to the Sakyong has become very good recently, and I feel a lot of, I feel a strong connection to him too, and kind of to try and understand what he wants, to try and, you know, make that happen.
When you inherited the helm of Shambhala Europe, and you were referring to that sense of shambles, what were your objectives at that time? What did you see? What did you feel was necessary to try to proclaim the victory banner?
I mean, at that time, it was completely unclear to me. I mean, I came into a situation, I was totally naive. You know, I said yes to a situation where I had no bloody idea what I was getting into, you know. And I think the first thing that instinctively I reacted to was taking care of the earth. So I felt that basically nobody was taking care of centers or groups, and all the basic things of how to take care of a container were just not being taken care of financially. There was no advice, there was no training, there was no, you know, legal. So that was my first instinct, was to take care of earth. And I ran around like a madman, you know. I didn't particularly hold my seat very well, but I was responding to what I felt were the needs, and to try and come up with ways in which everybody didn't have to reinvent the wheel all the time and spend so much energy on the container, but they could focus on the teachings or, you know, on just helping people more. So, and I think that was very important. It wasn't so conscious or intelligent, but it was very important because essentially it allowed people to relax. People felt taken care of. They felt that the organization, you know, people paid dues in Shambhala Europe. It wasn't kind of taxing, burdensome thing, but it was that there was a sense of that they would receive help and support, you know. And then, so within that, then people could kind of focus more on what their passions were, you know. So I think that was the first thing. And then, this, I guess the second thing was realizing that certain people had trained me to some extent, had given me some training, but that wasn't really happening so much anymore. You know, it's we've become a little bit more of a, there's a little bit of a danger of being an organizational bureaucracy. You know, you go, your path consists of programs that you go to, and there's no sense of real path in terms of as a, you know, one human being transmitting something to another human being. So I guess that's the second thing I feel very important now, is to try and strengthen that, that there's this real sense of transmission, and that people who have been trained well have a seat from which they can do that.
There's a parallel in what you're saying to the traditional teachings of the first thing that you do is you place the baby warriors in the cradle of loving kindness.
Yeah.
And then you slowly, you know, fan them with, things.
Yeah.
The breeze of joy and delight, and then you begin to bring them into the archery range of the warriors, and the Shambhala people are going to disqualify me because I probably skipped several lines, but hey, I'm already unemployed.
I mean, yeah, that's
so they can't fire me. But that's in essence what you did.
Yeah, I mean, basically now looking back upon it, we now give this trainings in Shambhala Europe, which is based upon the four lines in the Windhorst text, in the Windhorst lines, because I think that's it, is trying to raise the Windhorst situation. So having established the palace of the warriors, sense of taking care of the earth, and arranging the throne of the king, sense of forward vision, one contemplates the great eastern sun, so one then kind of, as a sangha, one also connects more to practice, one has a sense of forward vision, one's connected to practice, the earth is taken care of, then one can invite the imperial regents as guests, then auspicious things happen, you know, then the dralas arrive, then there's some sense of blessings that occur, you know. And I think that's kind of what I'm trying to do now all the time, is just take care of earth, give people a sense of forward vision, and also, you know, make sure we don't get distracted by too much institutional stuff that people practice, and then those three things have happened. And then actually, then it's not a mystery when auspicious things happen, because that's what the teachings say, and then organizationally, blessings can arise, and there can be a real transmission, a real basic goodness becoming manifest, the rictans becoming manifest.
You and I were talking a little bit also about the sense of freedom of being in Europe, because there is less historical institutional baggage. There's always bureaucracy as institutional baggage, but less historical institutional baggage. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, the kind of openness and malleability of Europe?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, that's, there's two aspects to it. One is that, for example, I helped coordinate the consecration, and my experience there was, you know, tremendous jealous God realm. So many different warring factions that you had to negotiate, you know. And it was kind of, you know, for me, it was very tiring, and I didn't have the experience to deal with that. Whereas in Europe, that does not exist. There's not so many seats of power, powerful people, you know. On the one hand, it makes the situation weaker in Europe. In North America, there's much more powerful, well-trained people. On the other hand, it makes things much more simple to do things, you know. So that's, you know, one difference, the sense of people are much more in harmony, you know. And then the second aspect is because we have, for example, one practice center where we all go to, or when the Sakyam comes to Europe, he's coming to Europe. He's not coming to Vancouver, or he's not coming to Halifax, or he's not coming to Boulder. He's coming to Europe, and the people figure out where he is, and they go see him. So there's a sense of that the Sangha comes together, and it's brought together by having one practice center, having a sense of, you know, still being young and being hungry, just, you know, the Sakyam doesn't come often. So that is a second aspect which, you know, makes things a lot simpler in Europe, because once you cannot, I don't think Shambhala leadership works without friendship. You know, friendship is the basis of, I think, being a leader in Shambhala. You have to know people, people have to trust you, you have to have appreciation for people and friendship. And that only happens when you actually meet each other. Emails and all these things, I have very little faith in. I mean, we have to deal with them, but they don't work as a mode of leadership. You know, you have to know people, you have to have trust in each other, you have to have friendship and appreciation, and then you can do things.
Do you think there's greater distrust between people in North America?
Yes.
And how does it manifest? Where does it come from? How do you deal with it? What's your feeling about it?
Well, I think it's a number of factors. One, it's wounds, you know. People have wounds from the history. There's a lot of things that happened. I think also that another factor is that the luminosity or the fire is burning much brighter here, and some people burnt out. You know, I think in Europe it was a much, you know, it was a smaller pond, you know. It was much more distant from the Vidyadhara. So I think a third factor is just then that, you know, people in, you know, there's so many kind of, from what I understand, flavors in the development of the Vidyadhara's world, that people got stuck on different flavors and felt that that was it. And whereas in Europe, no flavor was ever so intense, and therefore people didn't also figure that that was the real version of things. So those are all factors, I think, contributing to the historical situation, and then coupled with the fact of lack of, the organization doesn't function as well because it's such a large situation, people don't know each other. So all those factors, I think, come together in making the, resulting a lot more distrust and pain in North America.
And what do you think then might be the greatest challenge for the continuing development of Europe? If it's not in North America, I think the fact that there's this sort of re-arising mutual distrust in our community, we go through stages of trust and distrust and trust and distrust, but it seems like now we're all inhabiting some aspect of distrust. Yeah. But what do you think might be a big challenge for Europe if trust distrust is not so much the co-emergent aspect of what people experience on a regular basis?
I mean, I think a couple of things. I think, first of all, things are still subscale in Europe. You need a certain momentum and size. And so therefore you have to really take care of the saplings very carefully. You know, there's some kind of big tree trunks in North America. On one hand you can say, okay, they might be gnarled and the bark is very hard, but on the other hand the root is very deep. So I think we have that problem, that we have to really still take care of things very carefully. Goodness, beyond that, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that there's always a danger of losing the flavor of non-conceptuality in a practice, in a sangha, you know, that we become more of a club. Mm-hmm. But that's a worldwide situation. I don't know if that's more European.
Mm-hmm.
And then training people. I guess the third part is training people.
And what other teachers have been particularly helpful in terms of creating the profundity of learning and the profundity of lineage and the profundity of practice? What other teachers have helped in Europe? I think, for example, I know the Kempo is quite active. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, again, I think that's very, very important. Kempo comes to Europe and he teaches, and I would say, you know, a good 30 to 40% of the senior Vajrasangha study with him. And that, again, both helps them on their path and rouses the whole Vajrasangha in Europe without there being any danger of disloyalty. You know, in the sense of, not that disloyalty per se is bad, but it doesn't rouse the energies in a different direction. There's individuals who, you know, who say, I want to study just with Kempo, which is fine, but it's organizationally they still devote their energies to kind of furthering Shambhala vision, you know. So I think the Kempo has been the most essential one, and there's a sense that he's really an uncle, and there's absolutely no disharmony or problem if people go study with him. You know, it's just so kind of harmonious. So he's been the most essential one, and then others have come, but his role has been absolutely irreplaceable.
And in terms, if that's in the sense of the profundity of roots and having deep roots for strong practice, how about in terms of the vastness, reaching out and going into perhaps non-religious environments and presenting the sanity of Buddha Dharma?
Yeah.
I believe that Europe is actually almost perhaps has some kind of really best practice leading edge.
I think that there have been so many of, you could say, traditional teachers. It's just been the inspiration of individuals. And again, because we've had less conflict, we've tended to try and nurture that inspiration. So, you know, we have this organization which offers these Karuna training, Mendla trainings, which are 13 to 36 months programs, which offer the wisdom of, for example, contemplative psychology from Naropa into professionals, and that's part of Shambhala. You know, we're also taking over a hotel to offer a contemplative hotel where people in management positions can experience, you know, Dharma. And I think because we have a sense of friendship and a sense of working together, when somebody comes up with such an idea, and all people have such kind of inspiration all the time, they have somewhere they can go to, you know, and then we can try and support them. And so there's a sense that they're doing it with the blessings or with the support of the organization. And then you can help you recruit good people for them. You know, one of the key things is always finding good people, you know. So you can have the pool of the organization to help them with. So I think friendship is very important there. Yeah. And people have enough inspiration. They always have enough inspiration for a grand vision. And you just need to support them.
What is Karuna, Menla, and Nirmana?
So those are trainings that are offered by the organization called Upaya, which Shambhala Europe has taken over. And essentially they were started, again, by Sangha people as a separate organization. But they were, for example, Karuna training is a 36-month training based upon the contemplative psychology degree at Naropa. And it's offered in weekends and week-long deepening weeks. So it's a very transformative thing. It really transmits the very genuine heart of what the Vidyadhara taught on contemplative psychology without having to worry about any kind of, you know, credentials or scholarly accuracy, but it's about transforming, you know. So a lot of professionals come from there, from the world of therapists, psychologists, social workers, and they're very profoundly transformed by that, and they appreciate the teachings very much. But we don't necessarily force them to join our club. You know, they can do whatever they want with it. So, and Menla training and Nirmana training are similar trainings. One is contemplative healing, and Nirmana training is contemplative arts, so it's connected to the Buddhist teachings on perceptions and Maitri and so on.
Since we're just about to come to the end of our half-hour show, if you were brought into a room to be given your exit interview of the time you have spent as director of Shambhala Europe, and Sakyamipa Rinpoche was sitting there, and possibly Senmo, and definitely Trungpa Rinpoche, and you came to sort of hand in your sword and say, I have accomplished such and such, before you take your oath that you have, what's it called, the
retirement
oath, retirement oath. What would you tell them that you have accomplished?
I think I've tried to further trust, that people trust each other and know each other, and try to set up containers. You know, I'm not a teacher particularly, but to try and set up good containers where those people that, you know, have some connection, deep connection to the Dharma, can manifest and transmit something. So I think that would be the most important thing to me, that as a that as an administrator or, you know, being involved in Shambhala leadership, you have a sense of setting up containers where you know, Dharma can manifest, and passing those on, you know, not kind of holding onto them as your thing. And I think that's what I would hope to do, is, you know, with these various things that we're doing, that those are genuine places where Dharma can be transmitted, and where people who have any kind of training, any kind of realization, they don't have to be it's completely realized, but who have some kind of realization can transmit them.
And if you had to give one word of advice, not one, but a couple sentences of advice to the Vidyadhara and to the Sakya and to Senmo about what kind of person should replace you in terms of future challenges, what would you say?
Yeah, I think it's very simple for me. It doesn't matter what their experience is. The key point is that they have some kind of bodhisattva qualities, that they really care. And unfortunately, and this is sometimes hard to hear, but they have to be loyal, you know? Because I myself had this long phases where I wasn't sure what the Sakyam was doing, and it doesn't work. You have to have a sense of trusting that and doing it in the name of somebody. And so I think that's very important.
Okay. So now that we have a job description for the next leader of Shambhala Europe, hopefully people will be working on their loyalty and their commitment and their friendship so that it all carries forward. So, Chris, thank you very much for taking the time in your busy schedule to come talk to the listeners of the Chronicles. And I hope that when you get back to Europe, this friendship that you have established with the lineage and with the Sakyam and with the Sangha and with the North Americans and the South Americans, because I know you know them quite well too, and all the Europeans, can continue. And thank you for serving all of us.
Thank you too.
So, ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the Chronicles Dispatches, good night and thank you.
Thank you once again for listening to Chronicles Radio. Please tune in again next week for Holya's conversation with Helen Berliner. Until next time, this is Chronicles Radio wishing you a good evening.